Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm with Mike Konzol. Mike is a director at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on economics, inequality, and the role of public power in a democracy. He's the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy. And he has been featured in the Washington Post, Fox, Dissent, The Nation, many radio and TV appearances, etc. And today we're going to be talking about his brand new book, 2021 book, technically, the first book I read from 2021. It's kind of exciting. Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Would you start by simply talking about the book and what it's about and why you thought we needed to hear this story?
Yeah, absolutely. This book is the culmination of like basically the last 10 years of arguments and debates I've had with people about public programs and decommodification and the necessity of crowding out or putting really strong limits on the marketplace in our everyday lives. It's built around three assumptions. One is that, or three arguments. One is that freedom requires keeping us free from the market. Freedom is definitely defined by the fact that we have limits on how far the market can go in our lives, and that the government can provide programs or provide entryway into market in public programs that limit the extent in which the market determines our access to goods. The second is that this has actually been historically true, and this is what I think is a unique thing about the book that differentiates it from a lot of more dry and technical kind of policy books, is that it's a history of the fights over public programs, from the Homestead Act to the eight-hour workday to Social Security and Medicare and free college, and all the contradictions and conflicts and limitations and strengths of those programs, and how the people who fought for them and the campaigns for them really articulated freedom as being exempt from the marketplace. And third is that a lot of what is dysfunctional about our politics and our economy in the last 40 years has been about the extent of market dependency in our lives and the way in which the law has been reworked to roll back a lot of the historical limitations on markets and also extend through an active, what some people call neoliberal project of extending those markets into our everyday lives even further. And so I hope that the book provides a way to talk about these really urgent contemporary issues, but base them through a historical lens so that people can see that people have been fighting about these things for centuries.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe a place to go from here is to think a little bit about the ways in which this term freedom, and particularly around the idea of the marketplace, has been hijacked in American public discourse to basically mean, you know, an untrammeled free market, et cetera. And, you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, why has that happened? And what is the threat that the hijacking of these words poses to American democracy and our actual freedoms?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book starts with an introduction that talks a little bit about how definitely the right and libertarians and people who are kind of market fundamentalists really have hijacked the concept of freedom, such that freedom is really seen as being exemplified in the marketplace. That freedom is also kind of like a market. Freedom like creates these very vast inequalities that we normally associate with, you know, bosses and workers, that it's extended to the way freedom exists in the public writ large. You know, to me, and the book discusses people like, you know, historians like Eric Foner and political philosophers like Corey Robin, who really talk about how the left have kind of abandoned this territory, that they've really conceded the idea of freedom and liberty as fundamentally being conservative ideas or things that will be owned by neoliberals and instead retreated to other territory, where I think it's actually one of the most defining fights in our history. And it's terminology that should not and really cannot be given up. You know, we talk a little bit about how, you know, I work in a policy think tank and I've done a lot of policy over the past decade. And I'm at the forefront of a lot of these discussions about economics and inequality and the way markets are structured. And it tends to, even people who understand the need for active government often retreat to things like market failures or very textbook kind of almost like the algebra of economics, which ultimately will always not motivate people enough, I don't think, because it's not grounded in an aspirational view of how life should be, but also kind of fundamentally reifies the marketplace as the ideal, right? We just like, the market has failed us and there's these problems with the markets there, so we got to fix the market to get it back in shape, where it's like, no, people don't want the hours that they have to work dictated to them by a boss. They don't want their access to healthcare or education or a secure retirement or their family security dictated by how much money they can earn and save. And then there's a very active role for the government in promoting those kinds of freedoms. You know, we talk about freedom as non-denomination, and the book goes through some of the theories of freedom and some of the arguments about how we got here. And crucially, those same arguments about freedom as non-denomination and not being subject to arbitrary will of others. We think of that in terms of government, but the same thing applies in the workplace and in the marketplace, both because those are political realms, and they're political realms because they're created by the government. One thing that the book talks about in length, and something that's very obvious for centuries, is that the marketplace is a political construction. And so the same way we can look at things that we understand as nominally purely public things, like voting rights or incarceration, and understand whether or not they promote liberty and freedom because they're government programs, the workplace, the way corporations are set up, the way healthcare markets are set up, are all purely government projects because they're all created through property law and other forms of law and execution through the state. We should apply the same kind of questions about whether or not they are enhancing liberty and freedom, and not just in a strictly libertarian way about whether or not they function most like property, but whether or not they actually allow us to lead better and fuller lives.
Listening to you here, I mean, one of the things that strikes me, and I've seen this particularly looking at old labor struggles and the ways in which things that were once fought over very strongly are now seen as so naturalized that we don't fight over anymore. We don't even talk about them. And the ways in which you're talking about even, your liberal colleagues that will kind of just revert back to this sort of language of the market. And I'm wondering about this idea, I guess, of naturalizing the market of because as you point out, these are all government projects, right? I mean, the government makes choices. We make choices as society. But yet, in our conversations, not only just on the right or in the mainstream media, but very much among liberals, there's this sense of the market is this almost naturalized phenomenon. And I keep saying, when I write on a blog, the market is not gravity, right? It's not the set, it's not a law of nature. And so I was just wondering what it is like, what. It's kind of hard maybe to articulate a question around this, but why do you think that's happened? And, what do you think we can do about trying to make people understand that the market is a real thing that is created by people and that we can change?
Right. So the way the book is organized is it moves forward in time from the founding to recent years. And each chapter is a different sphere of life as we go through. And one of the reasons I really wanted to focus it in these different historical struggles is just to give people a vocabulary of how activists and fighters used to talk about things. And some of it's just so shocking. So there's parts about the Wagner Act, which created mid-century unionization, and the way legislators were talking about it were like just saying that this frees people in the workplace. It frees them from the tyranny of their bosses. It's described as labor's Magna Carta. By labor leaders. And it's just not a way you would talk about policy, even among like left liberal elites now. The 8-hour workday, even before the Civil War, even in the 1820s, there are things that are probably best described as general strikes breaking out in favor of a 10-hour workday in the 1820s in Philadelphia and elsewhere. And the language they use is in part because it's still very tied to these very philosophical Republican ideas around the founding, where they're saying, like, no one has the right to dictate us how many hours we spend. And they were talking about their bosses, like, we are given by God rights to like control our time. It's just a totally different framework for understanding what's going on. One that I think people are really hungry to re-engage now. The exact history of how we got here is complicated. And I talk about it in the book. It's not a definitive history of that. There's so many people writing about the changes that happened in the economy in the 70s and 80s. And we can talk a little bit about what I emphasize from the so-called neoliberal project, which I think is a useful term and one that's worth exploring in the book. But I think one is the idea of the idea of negative and positive liberty being taken to this extreme by libertarians that is in concert with business interests and a lot of people who oppose the New Deal. This idea that there is no role for the government outside the most minimalist of states. And, that I think that distinction that was introduced, part of a Cold War distinction, definitely an anti-New Deal distinction, basically eradicates the government, the understanding that the government is running the economy and creating the economy through laws and through other things. So I think this libertarian notion that kind of gets lodged in, I think is that coincides with a resurgent and aggressive business interest and dismantling and reorganizing the state in their own interest comes together on the libertarian front. But also on the liberal front, there's a retreat. There's a sense of discomfort with messing with the allocation of the economy. There's an essay I discuss in there by a very liberal economist of the 1960s and 1970s, James Tubin, who basically says, the ideal thing for egalitarian economists is to have a basic income, that the government would not provide public housing or provide public health care, except that, instead it would just give people money to do things. And as other people have noted out, obviously giving people money is very important for Social Security and social insurance, but the idea of giving people money so they can be more market dependent and thus be more subject to the way the market distributes and allocates things in our life really throws off the basis for opposing the market as a form of unfreedom. So the whole thing gets pincered in a couple different ways. And it leads to a real change, and a change that I think leaves people really alienated and unable to really articulate what's wrong with the economy in their lives.
Okay, so to build on that, then if people are unable to articulate what's wrong and have so bought into this, you point out all of these incredible historical examples of the ways in which the idea of freedom from the market, to use your title, has happened in American history. So let's just talk about a few of these, because I think that they are incredibly useful. I mean, just starting out, in chapter one, you focus on free land, which of course today is complicated because it gets wrapped up in the kind of politics of recognizing American genocide against Native Americans and all of this. However, right, and I think that one of the lessons here is that we have to be able to take what we can from our very flawed history and not just throw it all out, because there are useful things here that the way in which land was distributed, even given the racist side of that, actually does tell us a lot about the ways in which America developed totally outside of the market and in fact refusing to engage in a kind of classical market structure. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought, for the reasons you brought up, I thought very hard about whether or not to include a chapter on the Homestead Act. There's three reasons I ultimately did. The Homestead Act is obviously built on settler colonialism and dispossession, and I don't want to hold it up as an ideal form of social policy. The three reasons I think it's really interesting and important to engage with. One is that pre-industrialization, people just talked about the nation's wealth in a very different way. The people who are discussing this are very clearly, so the book follows Horace Greeley, one of the people who founded the Republican Party and a newspaper editor who's very prolific and talking about these things in the 1850s, most notably. And, he's very clear, like, do we want the frontier to be the empire of slavery? Do we want it to just be owned by corporations? Or do we want to try to build this idea of free labor and free people? Now, obviously, that's white men, and it's obviously built on dispossession, but they don't talk about the market as an abstraction. They talk about the slave power. They talk about resource extraction interests. They talk about settlers and individuals. And so the way that they're not even at a point where the market's that naturalized for them, I think it's just, it reads very alien to me out here in the 21st century. And I think other people will be caught up, be interested in that. Second, I think it's really important to denaturalize the idea of property. You know, we just talked about it before about property being a government relation, a contract, or a government creation. And that's very easy, I think, to explain to people when it comes to land. You know, this book is meant, obviously, there's a lot of expertise I draw on in my own policy life, and I draw on a lot of leading historians, but I want this book to be very accessible to everyday people and help educate them about these issues. And I found trying to get people to understand the social creation of property, land is the easiest way to do it, right? Because like your house does not know that you own it, doesn't even care, it's an object. What actually creates property and land is the fact that you can force other people off of it. And the government is the one who ultimately executes that. And they talk very clearly about this. We're talking about Thomas Paine and talking about his theory about how land is created, you know, land, property in land is created by the government. You know, Carl Poliani comes up with this idea of the fictitious commodities, and land is like one of the base ones because nobody creates land. The government creates property in land. And so I introduced very early in the book that idea so that we can then extend it to the workplace. And then by the end of the book, we're talking about student loans and the corporation and intellectual property is all being government creations. And as a reader, you have a little bit of basis to build up to those more advanced ideas. And third, the chapters, it's not totally rah-rah Homestead Act by all means. I encourage people to read it. I really want to see what people make of it because it ends with the Southern Homestead Act, which is a failure. It's an attempt to try to give land to the freedmen in the South during Reconstruction, and it fails. And it fails because two of the most vocal proponents of the Homestead Project, Johnson and Horace Greeley, are two of the people who turn hardest against Reconstruction. And they don't want land redistributed from slaveholders to free people. And you know, the book talks about how our notions of freedom from the market have to evolve with the marketplace and evolve with technology and the state of the economy and the historical evolution of capitalism. And the fact that they could, Horace Greeley in particular, could not make that turn and understand that their arguments about creating a free society on the frontier needed to be done in the South ultimately doomed so many people to Jim Crow and worse because they couldn't make that change. And the book is about change and the changing ideas of freedom. And I think the Homestead Act and the Southern Homestead Act just tell that story in a very powerful way. So I'm excited to see what people make of it.
Yeah, and I mean, just to reinforce it, I mean, not only is this incredibly readable and accessible, but I think it also is important, again, to talk about these difficult questions of American life, you know, from the 19th century, because they still have a lot of value for us if we can, you know, take what's useful and say, okay, you know, we're not going to replicate the Homestead Act. However, you know, when we're thinking about land, maybe there's something to be said here. But I was wondering if you would, you know, one of the people that I knew of, but didn't know that much about, actually, that I learned a lot from in this book to move into the 20th century is Isaac Rubinow. And I was wondering if you would talk about this figure that probably not too many of our listeners really know, and the way in which this early 20th century, you know, these early 20th century policy thinkers really start laying the groundwork for what freedom we do have from the market in the mid to late 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ayim Rubinow is a doctor turned policy, what we would now call like a policy wonk or policy entrepreneur. He would be like probably on Vox.com in the 1910s or whatever it was. But he has this very radical overarching view of social insurance. He is tasked by the government to come up with essentially an encyclopedia of all the social insurance experiments that have been going on in Europe. He teaches what is probably the first class in social insurance in the United States and writes the first textbook on social insurance in 1914. And what I emphasize in the book, and which is, I almost just want to like scream it, but I like try to like make it as part of the narrative, is like how much this book in 1914, it's actually on the shelf right behind me, I keep it near me, just is the answer, like all the stuff's there. Like it's 116 years later. or 160 years later. And, you know, now there's the internet and the 21st century digital economy and all these things, but literally all the answers about universal healthcare, about public pensions, about paid sick leave and maternity benefits, like they knew it in 1914. They knew that the only way you can really secure wages is through broad public insurance, that people will always get sick, they'll grow old, they'll be too young to work. Their people's ability to secure wages is not stable enough to build a free life around. And there's a powerful role for insurance. However, private insurance won't be able to fill in that gap because it is always fragmented. It is always trying to discriminate and profit. And the public can step in and do this so easily. Ayn Rubinoff is an actuary. He's a scientist of insurance and statistics that is literally with friends creating the data and arguments, the big data of its time, you know, the smart kids in the room of its time in terms of creating social insurance and the arguments for it. However, and he's also a committed socialist. So as opposed to the progressive era, which is a really complicated and weird era where people have a lot of wild opinions about everything, but are often trying to think about like how charity or private initiative can fill in the gaps in social need. He's very clear that those things won't work. They'll just replicate the problems. And the chapter is about him creating these arguments and trying to articulate them to Americans and butting up against the idea of voluntarism. You know, the why the United States is and has been a laggard in social insurance is so overdetermined. There's so many reasons ranging from Jim Crow and slavery to the Senate, to the courts. And one thing that I think is emphasized a little bit less now by historians, but has been emphasized in the past, is this notion of the American culture of liberty and voluntarism in small, the little platoons of the idea that small communities are best suited to handle these social problems. And at the time, this was a real thing. He understood it to be a real problem. And things like the idea that just like wide-scale charity or philanthropy or rich people doing kind things would be able to buttress against the insecurity produced by the new industrializing capitalism was just a farce. And it was almost worse than not doing anything because it created a kind of what one historian describes a no man's land, because you know, this private charity couldn't do it, but also prevented people from trying to answer it. And in our own era, where we turn to billionaires to solve our problems, or we think maybe like GoFundMe can help people, that story is so relevant and resonant out here. It was really exciting to get to tell.
So one question that I think we should answer, you know, building on the work of Rubinow and others, is that in the mid-20th century, we do get as close to freedom from the market as we ever really do in this country. And, you know, you talk about the labor movement, you talk about, you know, the rise of Medicare and Medicaid and other, you know, Social Security and the other big social welfare programs. But one thing that this nation never does, even though there are a lot of proposals around this in the 40s and 50s, is universal health care. And, you know, and so, and obviously 80 years later, we're still in the same, having the same problems and have hardly made any progress on these questions. And so I'm wondering, why is it that, you know, that even at this peak period where Americans really were making major strides in gaining freedom from the market, that healthcare just proved to be the bridge too far?
Yeah, so the book discusses President Truman's efforts to try to pass universal healthcare before talking about Medicare and how Medicare helped desegregate the South, particularly the Southern healthcare system, which was a story I knew a little bit about, but was really fascinating to get to dig into. And it's part of its past dependency. You know, we did not get healthcare in the 1930s. And by the time they attempt to try to do universal healthcare in the late 1940s, there's already the beginnings of employer-provided healthcare that is tough to dislodge. There's notably a very strong nexus between insurance companies and doctors who have a lot of financial capital to deploy against public programs, but also a lot of soft, like social capital to deploy. Doctors are very popular. Doctors spread a lot of money around. They're very influential in their communities and with elected officials. The same kind of problems we have now. There's also a thing Truman encounters where for Social Security, it's always easy to give people more money. So Social Security does not compete with private pensions provided by employers at the time in the way that healthcare, doubling up healthcare doesn't necessarily help you. So healthcare insurance doesn't necessarily help you. So they butt into that in a particularly unique way that makes it hard to expand. There's also, I mean, like so many things, it's so overdetermined. You know, you can, the Cold War is really rising up. And, you know, we remember that period is kind of peak social democracy. There's obviously a period of peak reactionary government as well with anti-communism, distorting the ability of people to make the case for public programs. And, you know, healthcare, in some ways, the big question is why didn't we get healthcare in the 19-teens, or at least why didn't we not get strong pilot programs in the states that could then kind of roll out the way Social Security sort of did in the 1920s and 30s? And, you know, you still, whenever you look at that, you want to look at the problems with the Senate, the problems with federalism, the problems with the courts, which have always pushed social policy towards a more privatized, more delegated, more hidden type of insurance, which is in no way less a government program. Like, it's still the government program that structures the employment contract that gives a lot of people employer-provided health care. It's just that it's hidden in such a way that makes politics around it very difficult.
And then, you know, and then beginning in the 1970s, of course, you have the rise of the neoliberal project, the stagnation of American growth, and eventually the conservative backlash. And, you know, and of course, that's going to, that rise of neoliberalism is very much going to infect the Democratic Party as well, in the Clinton years especially, but really bridging all the way from Carter to Obama. And so, you know, what is the lessons that we today need to take from the power of the neoliberal project and the ways in which it undermined even liberal support for new social programs that would help provide us this freedom?
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought a lot about how to approach the question of neoliberalism as a what I like to think of as a period of capitalism and an intellectual project. The term itself becomes very polarizing because sometimes you're talking about an intellectual movement. Sometimes you're talking about the right turn that center-left parties make across Western countries, which then gets you into very complicated questions about, say, President Bill Clinton or the Democrats, which I don't particularly want to litigate in this book. There's two chapters in the modern neoliberal era, and each, I think, tries to get at a specific point about neoliberalism and the scholarship around neoliberalism that I think it's very important for a general audience to take. And the first is that this is an affirmative state project to create an economy that does a certain kind of thing by conservatives and libertarians. I think it is very easy for a general audience to think, oh, well, you know, like libertarians are about small government or the government getting out of the way, or that they just trust everyday people more than they do government bureaucrats. But in the chapter on the economy that I talk about, the shareholder revolution, the strengthening of intellectual property rights, and the weakening of the public utility as a model of regulation. And each of those are very clearly a very aggressive intervention by the government into restructuring markets to benefit owners and bosses in a very short period of time in some cases. You know, so the one that I spend the most time on is the one I deal with the most, and I think it's the most indicative of this project, is the shareholder revolution. You know, before the 1970s, there's about 90 years of shareholder powers being weakened through just general practice, through small law decisions, through just evolving financial and corporate markets. You know, when Beryl and Means write their big opus in the 1930s about how shareholders essentially are a junior partner in the corporation, they describe it just as much as based on changes that had been happening as opposed to just things that would be created by the New Deal going forward. And then if you look at a handful of people, including Milton Friedman, University of Chicago economist, and crucially people in financial markets, they really do set out to change the nature of the economy in around a vision of the idea that corporations should be the property of shareholders and financial owners, and they are the ones who should have sole determination of it. So the idea that like the bad guys are not just like getting out of the way and things are falling apart, they are affirmatively trying to do stuff and they are aggressive in doing it, I think is very important for us to understand what we're up against. Second, is this a little bit more amorphous idea, but I think it's really important. I think people kind of get it, is the idea is that it's not just that they're making more markets or making things more dependent on the markets, is that neoliberalism is that project to try to change our idea of what we expect from the government and what we expect from ourselves, such that it is much more functioning like a market. And there I tell the story about the dismantling of free college, which is really shocking to people to understand how free college was up until the 1970s. I remember, I think one of my the best tweets I've ever done in success-wise was just a pamphlet, a new student manual for UCLA in 1951, where it's like, oh yeah, college is free, on like the 20th page as like a side note, just to remind you. And in fact, mostly bringing up the fact that like lab fees would be like $300 in current day dollars. And people are like, oh my God. It's like, yeah, like it was free and it was dismantled. And I talk about Ronald Reagan and the neoconservative dismantling of it, but I think the neoliberal dismantling of it in New York in the 1970s, where people who are not movement conservatives and not left-wing ideologues, not Goldwater people, take over New York City during their near bankruptcy and force tuition into the colleges, the really important system in New York, not because it's actually a real budget item that makes a big difference to the nature of the city, but as is clear by people in the statements at the time, as a so-called shock, that's the word they use, to tell people that they can't expect this from the government anymore. The government will be police and sanitation, but it will not be healthcare and public housing and free colleges. As a way of overhauling what people would be. And these are all like good Democrats mostly, or at least they're not people who are ideologically conservatives, but they're ideological and carrying out a project about what people can expect from the state going forward. And to me, that's a real essence of what the neoliberal project has done over the last 40 years.
So, you know, there's so many questions I'd like to ask, but we really probably only have time for one more, which is, I suppose that, you know, the neoliberal project's been very, very successful in many, many ways. And, it, you know, we know the price of college, you know, we know what the healthcare system is. These are major issues that are gaining more and more, you know, more and more people are going to the streets even to demand a new way, right? And, you know, we've seen this in over really since Occupy, so almost 10 years now of really quite a bit of direct action, as well as electoral politics around regaining this America that's been lost. And so what is it that we should take going forward as voters, as activists, as people who want to reestablish a system of economic justice in America? What should we take from your book that's going to help us to move that conversation forward?
Well, a few sets of things. One is I hope that the reason I wanted to ground it in history and people's stories of fighting these policy battles is to give people a sense of the historical depth of what's going on, and that people have been fighting these fights for centuries. They've often lost, but the struggle is real, and the way that they fight and the way that they articulate why they're fighting, whether it's World War II daycares and trying to keep them open in the aftermath, or if it's the creation of unemployment insurance and old age pensions, there's a language there about being free from the market that deeply resonates within our history. I'm kind of cheesy, and I think Americana is really important, and things like the idea of freedom are really important for the left to claim. And so, you know, drawing on these histories and drawing on these ideas, I think, really is motivating for a lot of people, a lot of normies and other people who are really thinking about these things anew for the first time. Another thing is that, and this might be a little bit more of a policy problem, but I think it impacts a lot of people in a lot of different ways, is that sometimes people get really siloed in what they're doing. So they're like really fighting for the minimum wage, which is really important, just fundamentally changes people's lives when the minimum wage goes up. Or they're over here and they're fighting for, universal daycare or child allowances. And I think, or they're way over here and they're talking about antitrust or the public corporation and concentration and public utilities. And I think there's a way in which people view their project as the one thing or the one thing. And sometimes you really see it where it's like, I'm dealing with, workers, not with redistribution, which is over here and bad, or I'm dealing with the nature of the corporation, not with trying to help workers. lawyers. And like, that's the thing that's your priority. But I think providing a framework where really what we're trying to do is limit the damages that the marketplace does to our lives and does to our freedom might help those different campaigns speak to each other better and sing together better, because I feel like it's all one project. And the quicker we understand that, the more we might be able to help each other fight for a better world.
It's all one project is probably the is probably a great slogan that we all need to keep in mind, you know, and I think that's super, super important. And I really appreciate you closing out with that. So again, we've been talking to Mike Konzel and his new book, Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand, published by the New Press and cut out in January of 2021. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,